The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes. Welcome to the Space Show, an hour of exploring new frontiers and exciting opportunities in outer space. Here's your host, Dr. David Livingston.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Sunday afternoon Space Show. At least it's afternoon here in California, which is where the Space Show originates. It's great to have all of you with us, and it's really great to have our two guests with us again today, and I will tell you about them in just a minute. But first, let me make a few announcements. You can participate in our show today using either email or you can use AOL's Instant Messenger chat. If you want to use email, send us messages at dmlivings@yahoo.com, or you can use drspace@thespaceshow.com. And our screen name for Instant Messenger Chat is all one word, Space Show Chat. Don't forget to visit thespaceshow.com. You can subscribe to the newsletter. You can read the newsletter, which is uploaded every Monday. And you can see the big button for new Space Show gear, which you may want to check out. There's a lot of cool T-shirts and hats and other items there that may interest you. Also, all of our programs are archived, and you can certainly listen to them at your convenience anytime, day or night, even on holidays. Also, take a peek at davidlivingston.com. You can learn more about me as the host and more about the show as well. Well, our guests today, we have two of them with us, have been on the Space Show before, and we have certainly talked about the Colony Fund and the Mars Society before, and that is what we're going to be talking about today with Tom Olson and Paul Contursi. Mr. Olson is the CEO of the Colony Fund, and he is the vice president of the Mars Society chapter, which is in New York. And the Colony Fund is going to be a public mutual fund which specializes in investments for the new frontier, which means space development. And we're all looking forward to the Colony Fund and its implementation and its actual operations. Paul is an astronomer. He's a space activist. He's a techno guy. And he is the president of the Colony Fund, which he co-founded with Mr. Olson. And he is also part of the upper echelon of the Mars Society's New York chapter. And they're getting ready to make some important presentations at the coming Mars Society conference in August of this year in Eugene, Oregon. And we have a preview of what Paul and Tom are going to be talking about regarding new developments with the Colony Fund. So, Tom, Paul, welcome back to the Space Show. It's great to have you both here.
Great to be back.
Just for the sake of new listeners that have not heard the show before, why don't one of you give us the nuts and bolts of the goals and objectives and some of the parameters of the Colony Fund?
Well, the Colony Fund will be a retail investment fund that will have a very, very heavy venture capital accent to it. And the idea behind the Colony Fund is to invest in space startups and new space technology, and to focus the interest of the many, many millions of people around the world who have an interest in taking a direct part in investing in the new commercial infrastructure in space that we hope to build in the 21st century.
So what do you mean when you say on your web page that the Colony Fund is the power of inclusion?
Well, David, at this point in time, if you want to invest in a space enterprise, there are certainly plenty of opportunities to do that if you are a wealthy individual. In the lexicon of investing, such a person is known as a qualified investor. And there are certainly a number of opportunities for you to do that if you want to invest $1 million or more. Unfortunately, there aren't enough people in that income range to do that. And so we thought that one of the things that would be an innovative aspect of the Colony Fund would be to make it available to people of modest means and great vision. All you need is $1,000 to invest in the Colony Fund. We will sell shares at $100 each with a minimum order of just 10 shares per order. So you don't have to be a qualified individual, to build a future.
When do you think the Colony Fund will actually begin operations and we can make our investments?
We're hoping to open our doors in the coming year.
So that's 2004.
Yes, indeed.
Incredible. You mentioned rich people, either of you can comment on this, but for those that are following the alternative launch industry, the aftermath of the Columbia accident and all the talk about keeping the shuttles flying, can we get another way to access space, and then the suborbital industry process, a number of really viable suborbital companies have sprung up, which are either operated and funded by, or they have an investor that is a phenomenally rich person, like Elon Musk, who created PayPal and sold it out to Compaq Computer for in excess of $300 million, is making the Falcon launch vehicle and funding it himself. Jeff Bezos of Amazon is doing his own company and for launch vehicles, and others are funding others. Can these rich people just break the dam barriers open and give us access so that everyone can enjoy it? And, of course, Bob Bigelow is working on, space hotels and is funding it himself. There's another one from the hotel industry. Are they doing us all a favor? Can we rely on them to accomplish, our goals for becoming spacefaring?
Well, let me tell you something. It's a good start. It's a darn good start. I mean, we need more of this, of course. I guess the point we would be making and the point we're going to make in Eugene is that rich people can't carry the ball all by themselves. Simply put, there's just not enough of them. We have, and I've mentioned this to anybody who will listen, really, we are about 30 years behind every other industry in this country in terms of privately developed entrepreneurial infrastructure. And in space commerce, that's a real problem. So we've got a lot of catch up to do. And there's a lot of reasons for those barriers. We can go into that later. But time being, the fact that some of these, a handful of wealthy individuals are seeing the potential of this and willing to stake some of their own fortune to make that happen is a great thing. But all they can do is help to open the door. For the rest of us to be able to walk through, a lot more needs to be done. This is what is kind of one of the reasons what's behind what Paul and I are trying to do.
I did a show a couple of weeks ago with my friend, and I believe both Tom and Paul know him, John Carter McKnight, because John wrote an article, an essay for SpaceDaily.com about the likelihood of the space infrastructure, which you just referenced, being built by the type of quasi-government, quasi-military contractor that are putting phenomenal infrastructure into, say, Iraq in our military efforts real quickly with great success without any of the kind of roadblocks or barriers normal companies encounter. It's as if these companies have the golden key and the golden pass to get the job done efficiently, cost-effectively, and they do it except they're quasi-military contractors. And he is concerned about the military coming into space because of the phenomenal success about and residing from this tier of companies that have now started to really blanket the American corporate landscape. What do you guys think about infrastructure coming from and assist with the military, even if the military is using space?
Well, a couple things on this. One, I don't think it's as dire as Mr. McKnight would like to suggest. Only because I think our current system is just spread too thin as it is. For them to be able, for all those military contractors and all those people to be able to actually set up any kind of a self-sustaining bases and even start a colony or something on a place like the Mars or even the moon, you're going to have to give up something. like Iraq. You see, there's just not enough in the budget, even at the military level, to be able to do something like that that quickly and do with that same kind of level of technological integrity. The other side I want to mention on this is that this continent was settled and colonized in almost the same way. They were kind of a public-private combination, like people like the Dutch and British East India Companies and other kinds of quasi-governmental units were put together to establish settlements in the New World in the 16th century. And you notice those settlements and colonies somehow become self-sustaining after a while, and all of a sudden other people with completely different ideas start showing up at the door. The next thing you know, a couple hundred years later, they're saying, hey, well, we don't want to be a part of the old country anymore. So colonies have a way of becoming independent nations eventually. So how the thing gets started maybe isn't as important as how they end up.
And of course now there's efforts by Russia as well as China and other countries to have a new space treaty that prohibits the military use of space, which is clearly directed at the United States military presence and technology lead in the world.
Will we sign it?
Well, I don't think this administration would sign it because I believe this administration's focus on space is through the military more than anything else.
David, if I may just add a comment.
Yes, everyone, this is Paul talking. We should have identified the guest earlier on, but I'm sorry. This is Paul speaking right now.
The military contractors who service the Pentagon and NASA, for that matter, they just have an easy deal going, and it's my guess that if for no other reason, they will continue to follow the path of least resistance. They have a rather incestuous system set up by which they supply goods and services to the DoD and NASA for a cost-plus arrangement that is their bread and butter and their stock and trade. The kinds of things the Colony Fund is interested in are quite a bit different and, frankly, are not necessarily contradictory. If some of these contractors want to build $200 million expendable launch vehicles for the DoD or NASA, they will continue to do that, and that's fine. But that's not quite the kinds of enterprises that Tom and I are concerned about when we talk about the Colony Fund. So I don't think we're really working in each other's side of the street here.
Is the Colony Fund having a potential interest in companies that might be interested in space infrastructure, or is infrastructure sort of relegated to a government type of deal as it is here in the terrestrial world? I mean, private parties don't usually go out and build highways or bridges, for example.
No, but they used to build airports before they got really big.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's a lot of things you can, there's a lot to that word infrastructure when it comes to space. I mean, infrastructure can mean computer software, communication systems, special tools, insurance, a whole host of things can all be wrapped up in what we call commercial space infrastructure. I guess that's keywords commercial, is that you're putting your money into stuff that's going to build wealth and create benefits both here on Earth and for use down in space. And building things at an incremental steps approach, literally from the ground up, pardon my pun, but and as opposed to the kind of the top-down hierarchical socialist enterprise approach, it's been typical of space development over the last 45 years.
Are you, at this point, either of you ready to say what your investment parameters would be in terms of return on investment, payouts, other types of parameters for the types of companies the Colony Fund would financially support? Or is it still too premature for that?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we can't mention hard numbers and things right yet. But, I mean, what we're going to try to do long term is really raise the bar in terms of the setting what kinds of parameters are going to be generally accepted in the space entrepreneurial universe. There are people out there. Paul talks about this a lot. He should mention this. It's the signal to noise ratio.
Yeah.
Of business plans that you see already. I mean, we haven't even opened our door yet, and I'm already starting to get, not inundated, but I'm getting business plans across my desk.
Well, I hope they're credible. I know I've talked on this.
But, you know, 9 out of 10 aren't.
Yeah, that's
the whole point. You and I
we know that if we go to enough space gatherings, after a while, you become a little weary of the folks who want to build an asteroid mine with their roommates from college. And if someone would only give them $20 billion to start, this is not a realistic way to build up a new commercial area. And the trouble is, once the embryonic space entrepreneurial sector gets a reputation like that, it becomes very difficult for viable business plans to get a fair hearing. And one of the things we hope we can do with the Colony Fund is give everyone a standard to shoot for. And the people who want to mine the asteroids with their brother-in-law and their roommate from college need not apply. We want real business plans. We want to know what technology exists, what technology would have to be developed. We want to know about intellectual property. We want to know about achievable goals. You know, one of the most gratifying things about the Rutan announcement on April 18th about the existence of this private human space program that Scaled Composites has mounted, is that this has been done on a very achievable series of successive approximations of capability. Mr. Rutan has been designing aircraft for the past 20 years out in Mojave, and he's tried to go a little higher, a little faster each time. And this is exactly what Tom and I have been talking about since 1999 to anyone who would listen. And we were very, very happy to see that kind of a stepping stone approach leading to all of these things that he has achieved. And we think that viable space business plans will look a lot more like that than plans that require $10 or $20 billion of hard capital, which just aren't going to happen.
How important to the business plan is how they address the regulatory market and deal with what regulations may or may not be required? And are you seeing business plans coming in that have a realistic way of dealing with the regulatory market?
Well, I wish we could all snap our fingers and fix the regulatory environment, but as we know, it's a very complex arrangement that we have today. For example, we were mentioning earlier some of these new suborbital launch systems, and one of the problems that we're having now is that certain United States government agencies may consider a vehicle an experimental airplane, while another agency may consider it a launch vehicle, and unfortunately, there are different parameters associated with that. So I guess we're looking for a certain degree of flexibility in some of the business plans we're looking at, and, you know, this is a new world. We're all kind of feeling our way as we go here, but one thing is certain. More people who want to get involved, the greater the pressure will be to redress the situation and clean it up a little. You know, the Transorbital Company wants to launch a commercial lunar orbiting mission, and they were told it would take 2 months to clear the regulatory hurdles, and in fact, it took them 2 years to do it. This kind of environment has got to be changed, and the more players we introduce, the more people we get directly involved, more pressure there will be on the powers that be to come up with a regulatory structure that makes sense and that is workable.
You know, this question may be a little bit afield from either one of you, but maybe one or both of you have an opinion on it. Quite a few people are increasingly speaking out that the U.S. should withdraw from the Outer Space Treaty because it makes the government liable for everything a private citizen or an American company does in space. And, of course, this is unheard of with any other kind of industry. General Motors is not looking to the government for the ultimate liability for its Chevrolet or Buick. Toyota doesn't look to the government or have the government being liable for its actions. So why should the government be liable for our actions in space? And they're claiming that this treaty is what's really behind the regulatory mess, and we should withdraw from it. Any comments or thoughts?
Oh, yeah.
I love that, Tom. Everyone, this is Tom talking. So.
Yeah.
The oh yes is coming from Tom Olson.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I'm just hearing this now from you, okay? And so I don't know the whole story behind this. Maybe you can give me some enlightenment, but I want to look at the motives of whoever it is making that kind of an assertion and making that kind of argument. While it sounds tantalizing on paper, yeah, we get out of the Outer Space Treaty, and they're no longer responsible for private commercial launches, and maybe in some way that'll open the door towards more private commercial launches. There's a two-edged sword to that, because the other side of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 says that space will not be militarized, and that no government can lay any kind of claim to extraterrestrial territory, like a chunk of the moon or a chunk of another planet. And that's the biggest plank in the Outer Space Treaty. Not so much that governments are responsible for launches on their territory.
So
by throwing out the one thing, you're throwing out a whole bunch of other stuff, and it really opens up a whole new can of worms, and it could either lead to government adventurism in the high frontier, or it will lead to everything just being shut down while everybody squabbles to try to figure out what to do next.
This was first mentioned in my presence at last year's Mars Society conference in Boulder, and I believe the speaker was Declan O'Donnell, who has also been a guest on this show, and he was talking about some of the attorneys that he works very closely with, and the one who he mentioned, his name escapes me right now, they had looked at the Outer Space Treaty, and they felt that it's going to be next to impossible to clean up the regulatory mess for not just launch vehicles, but for a lot of things the private sector can legitimately do in space, because the Outer Space Treaty holds governments responsible for everything their citizens and their companies do in space. And because of that requirement, the governments are going to demand a level of regulatory security to keep the government from being liable if a rocket blows up and kills 100 people in its launch path, or if something else happens. And since this type of liability is unheard of in corporate world and private world, they need to remove liability for what private companies do from the government and make it strictly an issue with the company, and set the requirements for what kind of insurance protection they would need, and that type of thing. So
that's just it. We can privatize the liability part of it.
So, but the problem, of course, and maybe some attorneys listening or those listening who might know more about this can comment in, but the problem is you can't withdraw from part of a treaty. You have to withdraw from the whole thing. And to go back to the UN and try to get a revised treaty that doesn't reflect this, given the state of the UN and the interest the UN normally serves, that would probably never happen.
No.
So they're looking at this one provision as a huge factor in the regulatory problems facing the commercial sector. And that's sort of the, from what I can understand, the origin of it. And if you look at this dispute with suborbital craft between the AST that wants to use a launch license process and other parts of the FAA that would classify the vehicle as an experimental launch vehicle, you see the whole clash right there, because, one definitely is an easier path for the private sector to follow, and that may not sit well with people that know that they're being held liable for what these companies do. Especially in a day where space budgets are, shrinking and funding is a problem, and our deficits are higher than they've ever been in the history of the world.
I guess my take on that is, in terms of international law, and I'm obviously no expert in international law, but just my gut instinct tells me on this: first, do no harm. So if you're gonna really consider taking apart the Outer Space Treaty and ditching it, then those in favor of that should also be in favor of a better way, something to replace it with that the international community will accept. So you still solve that problem, because you still have a problem of liability, and there's still the problem of, if you ditch the treaty, the governments with the most money are going to be the ones trying to stake extraterrestrial claims out in space, which is not going to sit well with the other 168 countries that don't have the budgets or the capability to go out there and stake claims of their own. And that would create a serious diplomatic problem, I think.
I've got a question that has come in. It's a multi-part question from Tony. And the first part of his question is, what do you see as the first products that the Colony Fund would provide capital for?
Paul, your turn.
Okay, well, there's a pretty wide range in there. You know, we're looking at a lot of different areas. It's funny because in the last few months, there's been so much attention in the press about space tourism and suborbital launch vehicles. And, of course, we're very excited about that, too. We think all that is important. But there are whole other areas that aren't getting as much attention, and we think in the long run they might be just as important. We were talking about space software before. We were talking about space insurance. This is an area that certainly uses a little innovation. And actually, I think one of the areas that we're looking at is remote sensing. I think if you remember just a few years ago, remote sensing was the sole province of the Defense Department and the National Reconnaissance Office. If anybody remembers watching the recent coverage of our military adventurism in Iraq, you could see a lot of commercially purchased remote sensing images from satellites, and that is starting to pick up a little bit. That might be an area that the Colony Fund might be interested in the early period, because we think that remote sensing has a lot of applications other than military and other than press, in terms of urban planning, in terms of crops, in terms of a lot of environmental monitoring, for example. I think that we haven't even scratched the surface in remote sensing. And I think that's just one of the areas that the Colony Fund will probably get into in one way or another fairly early on.
Okay, and the next part of Tony's question is, if there's some type of satellite-based internet connection service like Teledesic but aimed at the market instead of the whole world that your fund would fund?
Well, that's an interesting question. We haven't really been approached with business plans along those lines. The thing is, if we're talking about communication satellites, that's the only area really in space that has a vibrant commercial sector going on right now. And that's kind of its own thing, communications in satellites, in terms of these very large, expensive satellites that are boosted into geosynchronous orbit. However, if we're referring to something that could be put up with a lighter launch vehicle, smaller satellites, with a different approach to the market, that might be something that we'd be willing to look at.
The next part of this question is, what about solar-powered satellites? Dr. Jordan Kerr wants $2 billion to set up a laser launch system. Dr. Brad Edwards wants around $20 billion for the space elevator. What chance would projects such as these have in getting funded by the Colony Fund or even a portion of their funding from the Colony Fund?
Well, it's important to understand the scale that we're talking about for Colony Fund 1. We're looking at a total capitalization target of just $500 million. We're not talking about multi-billion-dollar projects at this point for the Colony Fund. We're looking at successive approximations and first steps. The son of the Colony Fund or the grandson of the Colony Fund might be the instrument to invest in projects of that scale. But in fact, due to the size of the capitalizations that we're looking at, we're actually looking to make much smaller investments in a much larger number of companies.
And then Tony has a final comment question that perhaps one or both of you would like to comment on. I mean, I certainly have my opinion about this. But his final comment is, what is preventing these projects from happening now?
By these projects, I'm not sure what he's referring to. Is he referring to the satellites?
Yeah, I think the ones that I mentioned, such as the space elevator, solar-powered satellites, and laser launch systems.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that are preventing it from happening. One of them is that in terms of a commercial project, which I assume he was referring to,
right,
we're really not seeing a digestible first step here. I mean, I don't want to make a blanket statement about all these projects because I haven't looked at all the business plans for them, but if memory serves, you know, the first step is give me $2 billion, give me $5 billion. And unfortunately, I don't think that the commercial space infrastructure has matured to the point where that is a feasible thing. Maybe an airline company could invest a few billion dollars in a new airline because we have a kind of a track record of that happening. And that is a sort of a standard way of doing that. But the commercial space business arena is very new. And I really don't see a situation that has any credibility right now that begins with step one, raise $5 billion in capital. I just don't see that happening. So I think one of the problems is that there aren't enough incremental steps that are digestible given the immature state of the industry right now.
The other thing I would say, because all these guys have been guests on the space show, and also I know that people with the space elevator are also part of your advising team, but I would say the technology is far from proven, and a lot of the money and effort going into these projects is almost basic research funding and basic research efforts to prove and validate the concept that they're that they want to have. I don't think that these guys would even say that they're close to being ready to launch commercial operations and commercial funding. They're still, from what I understand, in their research and basic development stage.
Well, I've read a lot about solar power satellites, for example, and in that area, I'm not convinced that there are any two opinions that coincide regarding the profitability of that, given the current state of the technology. And that's one of the main problems there. That even precedes the capitalization requirements there.
Absolutely.
So I think maybe if these plans could be restructured to the point where the initial investment could be a little smaller and the goal is a little more modest, there might be some way to get moving on those a little more quickly.
And, I think they're probably in various stages of securing the seed capital to help develop the technology and refine the research to demonstrate beyond a shadow of a doubt that they have a plausible commercial project, and here are the finances, here's the marketing plan, and we know that this market exists, and we know that this technology is viable, and I don't think they're quite there yet, from my take on having discussed this with them when they've been guests on the show.
I think in many cases that's true.
We're coming up on a break. Everybody stay where you are. We're going to be back in 2 minutes with Tom and Paul talking about the Colony Fund and space commerce investments and a lot more. So don't touch your dial. We're coming right back.
The Space Show would like to take a moment to thank each of you for listening and giving this program both praise and support. The Space Show, like other talk radio programs, depends upon advertisers and sponsors for their help and financial support. Tell your favorite business about the great advertising opportunities still available on The Space Show. Our ad packages are affordable, creative, and effective. They include web links and advertising, streaming internet play, as well as our very own internet radio station, in combination with your ad, on the Tuesday evening KKNW Seattle Space Show broadcast. Ad packages can be customized to fit your budget, and we know that we can have a positive impact on your business. For more information about advertising or sponsoring The Space Show, call Dr. Livingston at 415-435-6018 or send an email to drspace@thespaceshow.com.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back to the Sunday Space Show. This is your host, Dr. David Livingston. Our guests today are Tom Olson and Paul Contorsi of the Colony Fund and the New York chapter of the Mars Society. And don't forget, you can participate with our guest, AOL's Instant Messenger. Our screen name is Space Show Chat, and our email addresses are either dmlivings@yahoo.com or drspace@thespaceshow.com. And sorry, we don't have our toll-free line available today. We're using it for both of our guests. Paul or Tom, one of you give me a comment on this. Last year at the Mars Society Conference, some things occurred that brought home to roost the fact that within the space community, if you don't have an approved path to your science or to your venture, in many instances you get excluded. You get excluded from the sort of insider community. You can get excluded from the conferences. And it you know, compelled me to register a domain name for a potential conference called Forbidden Space. I think it's ForbiddenSpaceIdeas.com or something like that. ForbiddenSpaceScience.com. How does the Colony Fund plan on dealing with alternative scientific views on alternative business ventures? Is it open to new ideas and people that are out on the cutting edge or pretty far out?
Well, let me start in with this, and I'll let Paul kind of follow up. Odds are right now, at this minute, while we speak, Molly Ivins and Sean Hannity both have money in their 401ks invested in the same mutual funds. Now, they're about as far at the opposite end of the political spectrum as you can get. In case some of you don't know, Sean Hannity and Molly Ivins are political commentators. They have their own radio shows or in the newspaper. I just use that as an example of what goes on in the space advocacy community more often than not. We refer to it as science faction. And a lot of people get on each other's case because they think they have the one best way to go to Mars, and if someone else has a little different idea, then they might be dissed or excluded or something else. And this, and there was a case in point of this at the last Mars Society convention, and I thought it was rather sad. But what the Colony Fund is really as much about the power of green as it is the power of inclusion and the power of developing new space technologies for the 21st century. It doesn't matter what side of the fence you're on. I don't care why you want to go to Mars. I just care that you do. And we're going to give you a place to invest a little tiny piece of a much larger portfolio in a moderately risky investment that you hold for a long time. And hopefully that's going to help build that kind of space infrastructure so your son or your granddaughter 30 years from now or so will have a chance and a new life on another planet.
So if someone is pretty far out there, and let's just, since the Mars Society conference is coming up, let's use that as an example, and says, hey, there's some kind of life on Mars, or the face on Mars is real, or all of these strange photos that are coming back from the surface of Mars are absolute proof that there were Martian societies, or like Tom Van Flandern says, Mars was the moon of a planet that exploded, which makes up the asteroid belt. And here's my business venture, by the way. They're not excluded because they're out there on the fringe of scientific or theoretical presentations.
No, not at all. If you've got a business plan, they'll put money in our investors' pockets. And you can really make it stick and work. Well, we'll take a look at it. I mean, because if they believe that stuff and they have an idea for a media venture and they've already done their marketing plan and they already have a built-in market of certain people they know darn well is going to come to their movie or buy their CD or do whatever it is. If I think their science is totally bogus, but they have a way to make a whole bunch of money and open up people's minds to new ideas at the same time and get them thinking about other kinds of things and move things forward, I'll look at it, you know. So
we go back to sort of you're looking at the business fundamentals and not their thoughts or attitudes or reasons for wanting to be involved in space.
I don't care about their reasons for wanting to be involved in space. If they can figure out a good way to actually build some infrastructure, build some goodwill, build more public awareness, and turn a good buck while they do it, that's legitimate in my book.
And if I can just add to that, I think that one of the things that we've seen in the last 10 or 20 years, which has also been very sad, is that there have been a lot of tremendous technological developments in space that have not moved forward because they haven't received NASA's official blessing. And I think there's a lesson in that. I think if you try to impose a rigid set of standards without looking at all the options, in the long run, you pay for it. And if I could just pull one word out of a hat, it's TransHab. Remember that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right. TransHab was an inflatable crew compartment that was being designed for the International Space Station. But it was not, even though NASA paid for the initial development of TransHab, The prime contractor responsible for building most of the space station modules took great umbrage at their territory being trampled on, and that became a much more important issue than the fact that the Transhab would have been a safer environment for astronauts living aboard the space station than the standard aluminum module could have been. And I think there's a lesson in that. There are lessons in other kinds of space propulsion that, for example, that have not moved forward very much because NASA decided it wasn't invented here. One of those, of course, is solar sailing. Right now, the Planetary Society has a fledgling solar sail project. In fact, they have an exhibit about it in Rockefeller Center here in New York City during this coming week in a celebration of the first 100 years of flight. And I can remember contributing money back in the early 80s to a place called the World Space Foundation, who was trying to develop solar sail technology because NASA didn't have any interest in it. It wasn't invented in one of their centers. And I think we've got to be very careful. Sure, we've got to apply rigorous market standards, and we've got to look at what the marketplace will do in terms of commercial space, but we shouldn't be too overbearing in a rigid, preconceived set of ideas, and we should allow people at least to have a fair hearing.
And just for a point of clarification, Tom, a minute ago you mentioned that the Colony Fund was focused on the power of green. So you're really talking about money and not the Green Party politically, correct?
As long as our money is still green, that's what I'm referring to. The power of green.
I have a follow-up question from our friend Tony again, and Tony's follow-up is, Felix Baumgartner just flew a small carbon fiber glider across the English Channel and landed safely in France. He was sponsored by Red Bull. Would the Colony Fund be willing to fund the development of a one-man rocket that could make Felix the first amateur to parachute back to Earth from a 50-mile altitude? Could selling the movie rights or a TV special about the project make this venture profitable?
Well, we haven't really seen a business plan to that extent yet, but we'd certainly be willing to look at one.
But things like that aren't beyond the realm of possibility, of course.
So you're open to that kind of a venture?
Sure, I'm open to investing in media type ventures because I think that's also very important. Getting a message out any way you can, making a kind of a film like that, or even a higher end science fiction film that tells the right story the right way, but still tells a good gripping yarn at the same time, excites people and makes a lot of money.
And that's more important at this point because NASA has lost its direction and its vision. And we certainly can't rely on the space agency to inspire the next generation of space explorers and settlers, given what has happened to NASA over the past 20 years. I think you know what I'm talking about if you've been reading about the space plane now that they're thinking about developing as a crew vehicle for the space station. In some renditions, it's basically a souped-up Gemini capsule. And I take great umbrage at that, having lived through the Gemini era back in 1965. There's certainly not a lot there to inspire people. So I think building on what Tom said, I think if we can use the private sector to get people excited about space again, that's certainly a worthwhile aspect of the enterprise along with the profit.
Well, I think if we're dependent upon NASA to invigorate space or to energize or to motivate us or to do anything to open up the space frontier, I think it's going to be a long, long wait.
Well, that's always one thing that's really upset me about them because I think, for people like Paul and I and you too, David, space is one of the most exciting things you could possibly do in life. We eat, live, breathe, sleep this stuff. So, you know, anybody couldn't be excited by the potential of space. NASA as an organization is the one organization in the whole world who's managed to take space and make it boring to the average person. And I just don't get – it takes a lot of special effort to do that, I think.
I know, and the interesting thing is we've all met and we know people who do various jobs and are various scientists and engineers at NASA, and they're really jazzed by space. They're excited. They love having the opportunity to talk about what they're doing and bring space to the public, yet somehow at the institutional, at the organizational level, the story just gets made into a boring whatever. And, of course, when you look at what NASA is doing and what they propose, it really doesn't build upon the excitement and the motivation and the leadership that the NASA individuals bring to the table.
Well, I think, too, the problem is, too, people people don't get as motivated by what NASA's doing in space because for 45 years now they've been left out.
Yeah.
And this is part of the problem. It's easy to be advocate for all this stuff, but NASA is this little elitist crew here on this one little portion of the planet doing their own little thing with their highly trained specialists, and the rest of the public, they throw in their tax dollars, and all they get to do at the end of the day is applaud. And we talk about all the spin-off technologies, which are great. We've gotten tons and tons of spin-off technologies that filter their way down to the private sector. They've improved people's lives. They've made us healthier and stronger, and we've got nonstick cookware. We've got all this great stuff. But right now, I'm so frustrated at this point, David, the only spin-off I want anymore is a ticket to ride. And that's what we're doing this for. That's why Paul and I get up in the morning. We want people to have a ticket to ride out into space. They want to get on, not get on eBay or get on Hotwire, and they can go there, and they can find a suborbital space company that's willing to sell them a ticket for so many thousands of dollars so they can take their family on the ultimate joyride. We've been waiting for that promise from the NASA people for 30-some-odd years.
And if we don't do anything, we'll wait for another 30. You know, it's just amazing. I was talking to somebody from the New York Observer about this just the other day. We are willing to put up with so many restrictions and limitations in space that we would never even dream of withstanding in terms of any other area of communications or technology or transport. People have been flying in space now for over 4 decades. Can you imagine what the state of affairs would be if 4 decades after the Wright brothers' first flight in 1943, it would cost $100 million to take an airplane ride, and it would take 14,000 engineers 6 months to prepare that airplane, which would drop very expensive pieces of itself in the Atlantic Ocean before it arrived in London, for another 6 months refurbishing by another 14,000 technicians to fly back to New York? Nobody would put up with it.
Yeah,
nobody would put up with it.
Think how many frequent flyer bonus miles we'd get for the price of that ticket.
Ooh.
I have a chat message about the Colony Fund from William in Fort Collins, Colorado. He wants to know what the approximate Colony Fund portfolio asset allocation will be, and will it look like a traditional mutual fund? Will it be considered a risk mutual fund, an income fund? What do you guys think?
Well, I think I can address those by giving him a rough approximation of what the structure of the Colony Fund will be like. Basically, yes, the Colony Fund is a risky fund. It's a long-term risky fund, but that's okay. There are plenty of long-term risky funds out there. You know, David, right now there's $3 trillion invested in mutual funds, and if we were just to assume that a tiny fraction of that, say 5%, were in risky portfolios, and I think the actual number is probably a lot higher, that's $150 billion. That's an awful lot of money, and 1% of that is 3 times what we would need to capitalize the Colony Fund one. So, yes, it's risky, but there's certainly precedent for that. As far as asset allocation is concerned, the overall structure of the fund that we envision is that about 5% of the fund, a very small fraction of it, would go into what we call our adventure portfolio. And these would be privately funded space missions that the Colony Fund would undertake in cooperation with other either profitable or nonprofit space groups that would actually turn a profit for our investors. 25% of the fund, roughly, would be invested in the same kinds of equity and debt instruments you would find in a balanced mutual fund. The reason we do that is to provide our investors with a little bit of protection against volatility in interest rates or equity prices. But the lion's share of the fund, the remainder, We go into various space startup companies that meet a rather strict set of standards in terms of business planning, market definition, and so forth. So, yes, it is risky. It is long-term, but we're doing what we can to mitigate that risk given the situation that we have. And we certainly don't advocate that any of our investors bet their kids' college education or their retirement solely on a position in the fund. However, any investment advisor worth his salt will tell you it is certainly appropriate to put a small portion of your portfolio into a high-risk investment that has a huge profit potential over long periods of time. And Tom and I are firmly convinced the Colony Fund fits that bill very well.
I have a rather long email here from Betsy in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm going to paraphrase it. So bear with me, and then either or both of you can take a stab at this. What she says is, why do you think a space investment for the Colony Fund can be profitable? For example, no government or its space agency knows a way to actually access space in an economic fashion. It doesn't exist. Don't you think this fundamental issue shows the folly of making an investment in space or space commerce? If you can't even get to space economically, how do you think your Colony Fund can make a return on investment for any of its investors?
Well, Tom, do you want to take that one, or do you want me to take it?
We can play tag team.
Well, first of all, I'm just going to start, and I just want to mention one thing. Betsy's absolutely right. Governments have not invented a profitable way or an economic way to get into space. But the important point to mention is that wasn't their intention, and that's why we are in the position we're in. Tom, take it away.
Thank you so much.
You guys are laughing, but the truth is, Betsy's view is a view that is really out there in the mainstream and has absolutely been fostered and encouraged and nurtured by all of the government space programs around the world, including NASA. This is their mindset.
Let me put the comment another way.
Let's address it this way. First of all, there are companies out there making a profit in space right now. There are private launch companies or semi-private launch companies that are launching satellites. The satellite launch services business and the background services for satellite launches and the satellite and the companies producing electronic communication satellites and other kinds of satellites, they have been in business making profits for upwards of even 30, 35 years. So those kinds of things are already being done. But what we're trying to say is that's the only business model that can be viable from an expendable launch vehicle, one best way, top-down, hierarchical, NASA-centric kind of approach that we've developed over the years. And that's where we've gotten into this kind of technological trap, kind of a dead end. We want to start from scratch. We want to reset our clocks back to 1965 and say, okay, what if we were starting with a blank sheet of paper? How would we build a commercial space infrastructure that really worked? And we would take our cue from the history of how commercial airlines got started. And using an incremental steps, competitive approach, using free minds and free markets and the creativity that's out there and the energy to just go a little higher, a little faster, a little farther, a little cheaper. You start by getting involved with companies that are doing things like zero-G flights, parabolic flights, and you get involved in that, and that gets some people in. That gets people thinking about, well, I could do a little bit more. Then there might be some companies that are shooting people up in jets to the upper atmosphere and getting them a little taste of the outer 90% of the above 90% of the Earth's atmosphere. Next step would be suborbital. Working on things like that and that kind of approach, building markets slowly over time. This is how we do things in every other sector of our economy, and we haven't done it with space because we started off on the wrong foot, literally. Hold your turn.
Yeah, Betsy, what I would say to Betsy is that what we think about a lot, what we mention in all of our presentations, is that the general perception is absolutely backwards. The general perception is that space is so complicated, so expensive that only governments can oversee it. Well, Tom and I put a different spin on that entirely. Space is expensive and complicated because governments oversee it. That's the way we look at it. We have to look back at the history of the whole Apollo era and our reach into space. President Kennedy did not stand on that podium at Rice University and say, before this decade is out, we will develop an economical way to send people to the moon. He didn't say that at all. We have to beat the Russians, all or nothing, throwing all our resources behind it. It's got to be quick and dirty. It's got to be done in 10 years. And that's what we ended up with. Unfortunately, it was a great achievement, but unfortunately, since 1969, everything else we do in space is based on that model. And that's what Tom was referring to. If we look at the aviation model, it was a little different. It was successive approximations. Everybody went a little farther and a little higher and a little faster than the competition. And from the beginning, efforts were made on the part of aviation promoters to actually encourage the participation of the average person, whereas in the case of spaceflight, there's been a very active campaign going in one way or another to bar the individual from taking part. And those are the things the Colony Fund wants to work against. And I think that if I could point to an example that Betsy might want to take a close look at, if she goes to the Scaled Composites website, So you'll see that Mr. Rutan and his friends have devised a privately based human space program that costs a grand total of $20 million. I can bet you that NASA spent more than $20 million on office supplies last year, and that's a perfect example of what we're talking about.
Going back to the Colony Fund being a public fund where people across the country can get into it for $1,000 per investment, have you had any talks yet with any of the major financial or brokerage companies like Merrill Lynch that might help raise the money for the Colony Fund and be the brokers of record or the underwriters?
We're still looking at that right now. We do have one possible broker of record who's basically asked us to put together a proposal, and they can run it up the flagpole there, and we're into discussions with them. That probably won't see any fruit from that before the fall, but there's some nibbles, yeah.
Is the current state of our economy neutral, a real negative, a plus, or just sort of a minor irritant for your timing?
In an odd way, I think it's a plus. I think the people have been so burned by the dot-com, number one. And by the way, the dot-coms are an example of what the Colony Fund does not want to invest in. If you can remember back to the late 90s, David, I'm sure you've seen many different prospectuses for these Internet companies that will state very, very clearly in their prospectuses that they have no product. They don't expect to make a profit in 10 years. And you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and then they sell for 300 times.
And they sell for $300 a share. Yeah. We don't want to emulate that model. That's not what we're looking at.
Burn rate are not part of our lexicon.
Yeah, we're not looking at that at all. So something to think about.
Let me ask you if this would be a factor in your analysis of a business plan for the Colony Fund. And also, I'd like your thoughts on this in general. It appears that somehow in this country and in our government, we have evolved to a point of zero tolerance for accidents and death in risky business. And this was never the model in early days of aviation, where lots of people had crashes and accidents and people were unfortunately killed. But the field developed and it moved on. And now the loss of astronauts, the loss of people who fully know the risk they're taking and are willing to take that risk to go into space to do what they're doing, it seems that we have a model that you can't have an accident, and then if you do, the company's going to fall apart or NASA's going to fall apart. And certainly if it fell apart, that would affect, the investment that the Colony Fund made in that company. Let's say it was a launch vehicle company that had the unfortunate accident. How do you consider our propensity for tolerance of accident and loss, and what do you think in general of how we've become so zero tolerant and what role that plays in space development?
Well, I think one of the things, of course, that intensifies this feeling of loss when something like this happens is that we have instant coverage of it. Back in the early days of aviation, you might see an article in the newspaper the next day, but you wouldn't watch it live on television. I think that hits home a lot harder. But, David, when we're talking about risk tolerance, it's very important that we talk about whose risk we're discussing here. Certainly, NASA has become very risk-tolerant on a lot of levels to the point where it's almost pathological. However, in all the recent surveys that have been done, and in spite of the Columbia accident, a fairly large chunk of the folks out there who might be able to afford a private flight into space is still interested in taking one. So I think there's probably a bit of a disconnect here in terms of the government-dominated space sector and in the now-emerging commercial space sector. I think that people, younger people especially, I think put it into the context, well, if there's an airline crash, airliners don't stop flying around the world for 3 years while they figure out what happened. And I'm hoping that, I'm hoping that space flight becomes safer, but I'm also hoping that it gets put into the same context. In an accident need not stop operations or exploration. We certainly can't operate under that principle because taking the long view, we never have.
Absolutely. And, of course, with the space shuttle, you have an inherently risky vehicle that probably can't be made safe to begin with, which just compounds the situation.
Well, we certainly had an opportunity to correct that twice, and we've blown it both times. back during the Challenger era, and back in 1986, we had an opportunity to step back and say, well, gee, we only have one way to launch humans into space from the United States. It's government-dominated, and now we have to shut that off for a couple of years. How are we going to maintain all these expensive space assets we have? And apparently we had an opportunity at that point to take a step back and get the commercial sector more involved, and we elected not to. And here we are later, and 17 years later, we're in the same position, but this time it's worse because we have even more expensive space assets. And now, of course, everybody is scrambling around to do all these workarounds to keep everything flying. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like if we leave NASA to its own devices, we will learn that lesson this time either. So that's why another reason Tom and I feel it's very important to get the Colony Fund underway and to open up more pathways into space for more people.
Actually, during that era that you referenced, we gave the market for commercial space to Ariane, which is over there in France and Europe, and today still they are the leading commercial launch company.
I was just going to mention that, David. In fact, after Challenger, our biggest problem was, you know, what about our commercial satellites that are sitting on the pad waiting to go? Ariane basically bailed out our U.S. companies by picking up that slack.
And they still are the leader today.
And they're still the leader today because of it. We gave up a lead to them because of it. Now, the same thing looks like might be happening with the loss of Columbia. There's, Russia is now offering to, at least temporarily, pick up some of the slack in terms of ferrying crews and supplies and other things using their Soyuz craft. So, of course, you know, that's going to give them some, somebody's going to have to pay them for that. That's going to be some more hard currency in their pocket and good for them. They're becoming the space capitalists now.
Absolutely.
And let's not forget that our friends in the People's Republic of China are planning to launch their first human cruise into space within the next 100 days or so.
Which brings me to an important question I'm going to pick up on the other side of this break, but for everyone in the audience to ponder, as well as our guest today. I'm going to want to ask Tom and Paul if the Colony Fund will be looking at foreign companies and their efforts to invest in commercial space. So everybody stay right where you are. We will be back in about 2 minutes. Stay tuned.
The Space Show would like to take a moment to thank each of you for listening and giving this program both praise and support. The Space Show, like other talk radio programs, depends upon advertisers and sponsors for their help and financial support. Tell your favorite business about the great advertising opportunities still available on The Space Show. Our ad packages are affordable, creative, and effective. They include web links and advertising, streaming internet play, as well as our very own internet radio station, in combination with your ad, on the Tuesday evening KKNW Seattle Space Show broadcast. Ad packages can be customized to fit your budget, and we know that we can have a positive impact on your business. For more information about advertising or sponsoring The Space Show, call Dr. Livingston at 415-435-6018 or send an email to drspace@thespaceshow.com.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back to the Sunday Space Show. I am your host, David Livingston. Our two guests today are Tom Olson and Paul Contorsi. They run the Colony Fund. And just before the break, I was asking them if they will be investing in foreign companies, and if they did, would they have to have ADRs? Would they have to be regulated here or listed here? Or are you guys not even going to consider foreign companies right off the bat?
It's not our first thing to do right off the bat. I mean, right now our biggest goal is to get this thing going and get ourselves fully funded and get investors online and start because we have no shortage of people right now in this country sending us business plans or making inquiries. I mean, there's a lot of great guys. Despite of all the chaff that you see out there, there is a lot of wheat. There's a lot of people out there that have a lot of good things to say, and they have a lot of good things they want to do, and we'd like to be able to take part with them. I'm going to concentrate on that first. But, yeah, ultimately, if we get into Son of Colony Fund or Grandson of Colony Fund, as Paul mentioned earlier, it would be for much larger amounts of investments. And that we might take a global approach. I have no problems with working with Europeans or the Russians or the Japanese. In fact, at the World Space Congress last fall in Houston, I actually talked for about 20 minutes to some people in the Chinese delegation. They had a very nice pavilion there. They were showing off some of the stuff that they were doing. Their English is very broken, but they kind of understood where I was going with them. I asked them about, you know, possible, you know, commercial ties and things, and they weren't averse to the idea. So, I mean, long ways to go there.
But, how was your Chinese, by the way?
Horrible.
He does speak Russian, though. You should know that.
Yeah. They gave me a fortune cookie, though. I don't know.
Well, the Russians, through a bunch of political nightmare situations, were not really represented at that World Space Conference,
right,
which I think was unfortunate. So, down the road, you would look at foreign companies, foreign operations, foreign investment potentials, but that's not part of the initial work that the Colony Fund
is doing. Not right now. I want to build infrastructure in this country because we have the best shot at getting it done the fastest, I think, even with our regulatory environment and even, you know, bureaucratic roadblocks. I think we still have a better shot at it in what's, you know, left of the free countries, so to speak, than we do in a lot of these other places. I mean, it's you get involved in international stuff. It's not just the trade agreements that go back and forth, and there's the security issue and a lot of other things that really could create a nightmare unless you're just putting in a little money in a very specialized component manufacturer offshore that's doing something that you may not import, you may not even be importing into this country.
Just to catch up on a point of housekeeping, which I should have mentioned up front, is for everyone to know that I am an advisor with the Colony Fund, and I'm listed in their advisor section on their website. So I'm very, very supportive of what Tom and Paul are putting together and doing, and I want to be totally up front and above board with all the listeners. I should have mentioned it when the show started, but at least it's being mentioned while we're on the air. So that's just a point of minor housekeeping there. When you present at conferences and you talk to people, especially non-space people, how do they receive the idea of the Colony Fund and a possible investment in it? First from people at space conferences that already have an interest in space, and then from the non-space people that you talk to.
Well, it's interesting you asked that question, David, because we have found tremendous support for what we're trying to do in the space advocates community. We explain very thoroughly that our doors are not open yet. We're not ready to do business just yet. And people still approach us privately, talking about different ventures and providing us with information and asking, set up dialogues. And that really is not so surprising. What has been surprising to us is that the response from people who are not as connected with the space advocacy world as we are is incredibly positive. Any offhand discussion of this idea that Tom and I have both been involved in, the response is always, cool, fantastic, it sounds really great, this is what we need. And if that's any indication of the kind of response we're going to get, I'm very encouraged by it.
Well, I've heard from people who aren't even, you know, interested in space normally. They don't wake up and live and breathe it like we do. But, I mean, there's people from all walks of life. They could be doctors and nurses. They could be secretaries. They could. I knew one guy. I talked to a guy, you know, working on my car at an auto body shop. He saw my business card. What do you do? And they responded. Paul said the response is all the same. Cool. You know, it's like space is something they think about every day. But if you put it in front of them, they'll go, oh, okay. You know, they do consider these things, and it makes sense to them when you explain it, you know, in the right way.
You haven't mentioned your your website yet, but it is thecolinfund.com. We encourage everyone to visit it, and you can get lots more information there than even what we've been talking about today.
Yeah, no the there, though. It's just colonyfund.com.
Okay. What are you going to be saying about the Colony Fund at the Mars Society? Anything different from what we're talking about here?
Well, I think the angle of our discussion at the Colony Fund is that we want to caution people against sitting back and waiting for a handful of millionaires to open up the age of commercial spaceflight, because Tom and I don't think that's going to happen. We think that some of the wealthy individuals who have expressed an interest in spaceflight and have started their own ventures are doing a wonderful job. They've certainly accomplished a lot of really terrific things, but I think the point we're going to make in our presentation is that if we leave it at that, we're not really going to move forward. More people have to be involved. The average person has to get involved. We can't just leave it up to a handful of millionaires to open up the future for us. We've all got to take part.
In the last few minutes of the show, let's switch our focus for a minute to Mars. Mars is going to be the closest ever to the Earth in the last 50, 60,000 years. On August 27th, it'll be around 30 million miles from Earth. So hopefully everybody will have a clear view from now on until the end of this month to go out and just see how bright and red and close it is. And, of course, the Mars Society is having its big conference coming up. In your opinion, both of you, how important does Mars weigh in as a catalyst, a facilitator for space commerce, for space investment, for becoming spacefaring? Or is it just something of interest that the government ought to explore? And it really isn't related to anything we've been talking about tonight.
Yes to everything.
okay.
Yeah, sure, it's something we should be exploring anyway. But people have been fascinated with Mars for thousands of years. That fascination has never gone away. How that will translate into increased investment into commercial infrastructure, where we'll all of a sudden, you know, get excited and everybody will want to get involved and start moving forward out to the red planet, that depends a lot on what we ultimately find there. If we've got several probes going there now, and there'll be more following in a couple of years, I mean, we find definite evidence that there's just oceans of water sitting a couple of feet under the Martian soil. That's going to spur a lot of interest. Things of that nature.
And by the way, David, since you mentioned August 27th, if anybody is in the New York area, if the weather is clear on the night of August 27th, the Mars Society of New York is inviting everybody who has a telescope and wants to look through one to come to the Long Meadow in Brooklyn's Prospect Park at about 10:30, and we're all going to take the closest look you can of Mars from Earth in the past 60,000 years.
Be an incredible opportunity. I'm just hoping the fog in the Bay Area isn't here. If it is, I'm heading north for sure. That is for sure. Guys, we're almost out of time. So in the remaining couple of minutes of the show, why don't each of you, one at a time, tell our listeners what it is you'd like them to know that is most important to you and to your own personal vision, not just about the Colony Fund, but why you're doing what you're doing. And let the listeners know, you know, what's jazzing you and driving your vision about all of what we've been talking about.
I guess what's driving me is the fact that for every generation, especially in this country that's come up, parents always wanted for their kids to have a little bit more than they had, and they make those sacrifices, and they work extra hours and do what they had to do so their kid could have a better education or get a better job or have a better life. And I see those kinds of opportunities starting to flatten out in this country right now. I think space commercial expansion can raise the bar again. I want my kids and my grandkids maybe someday to have more opportunities than Paul and I have had in life. And that's the main reason I get up in the morning and want to do this kind of thing. I want to see a better future for our children and our grandchildren rather than just sitting around and playing video games.
Well, guys, we're not that old. We are entitled to a better future, too, if we're willing to make the commitment and work for it. Come on.
Absolutely.
Don't put me out the pasture yet.
Well, I think Tom is right, and I think that we grew up, our generation referred to as the children of Apollo, but we're the orphans of Apollo because everything just sort of stopped, and it's time to reawaken the spirit of exploration, discovery, and entrepreneurship and to get back on our journey to the stars. It's time to pick up the flag and get moving again.
Do you want to give out contact information in addition to www.colonyfund.com?
Right.
If anyone wants to reach Paul or Tom, you guys want to tell them how?
Just send an email to info@colonyfund.com. That will get to me.
Okay.
And I pass stuff along to Paul as well.
Okay. I want to thank you both for being back on the Space Show. It's always great to have you as a guest, and I know from the listener's point of view, they share that with me.
Well, thanks very much, David, for having me.
I really enjoyed it.
And I look forward to our doing it again in the near future, and I certainly am looking forward to seeing you up in Eugene, Oregon in about 2 weeks.
Well, that's right. It's getting close.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're about to tackle how to get to Mars again every August. This comes up, right? So I want to invite everybody to come back to the Space Show on Tuesday. And remember, our Tuesday programs are now rebroadcast on KKNW at 11 p.m. Pacific time. And then again the following Sunday for another Space Show. And Tom and Paul, many thanks for being here this Sunday afternoon.
You're welcome.
Okay, everybody, have a great week. And the Space Show will be in touch with you again on Tuesday. Goodbye.